We wish to thank a special group of friends of WILL, the members of the WILL Legacy Circle, for providing for the future of WILL Radio through gifts that they've planned in their wills and estate documents. For more information about making such a gift, call Don DeBeard at 217-333-0850. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Sharon Weinberger. She's a journalist who specializes in reporting on national security and defense issues. And we will talk about a recently published book that she has written. The title is Imaginary Weapons, A Journey Through the Pentagon's Scientific Underworld. It is published by Nation Books and is out now in the bookstore. You certainly should be able to find it. In the book, she explains that it was a couple of years ago, back in 2003, that she first heard about plans to build a frightening new weapon, something that would pack the power of a nuclear bomb into a package that would be small enough, literally, to fit into your hand. Now, she also explains in the book that a panel of scientists working for the Department of Defense had reviewed this idea and concluded that it wouldn't work. Even if it could work, they said, there were some significant problems associated with it. But, as she reports in the book, the Defense Department just could not give up on this idea and decided to fund it anyway. And it turns out to be one of those ideas that, within some circles in the Pentagon, just won't die. As we talk this morning about the book and about why it is that the Pentagon seems to have this tendency to fund weapons projects, at least some, that are doomed to fail. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Sharon Weinberger has written for a number of publications, including Slate and the Washington Post magazine. She is the editor of Defense Technology International. That's a bi-monthly editorial supplement to Aviation Week and Space Technology. She makes her home in Washington, D.C. She's joining us this morning by telephone. Ms. Weinberger, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
It's a very, very interesting story. It's fairly complicated, so we'll see if we can hit the high points here and give people a chance to get the basics. And I suppose to begin, maybe one way to begin, is to talk a little bit about isomers. We'll do a little physics for people here, but talk about isomers and this basic idea of the isomer bomb. Maybe first you could just, can you explain in a very simple way what an isomer is?
Sure. Basically, the most important thing to know is that this book talks about nuclear isomers. There's also chemical isomers. And to put it in very, very shorthand, and the best way that it was explained to me, is that a nuclear isomer is basically sort of a charged-up form of a regular atomic nucleus. So you know, one analogy that was used for lay people that I thought was very nice was it's sort of like a balloon, a blown-up balloon. And that's kind of an analogous way to think about a nuclear isomer, just a charged-up form of a regular nucleus.
Okay. So what we have here is something where there's a lot of energy stored in this thing. I guess, again, that's sort of that as I understand it. And to carry the metaphor on, when you think about the blown up balloon, the idea here is we have all this energy stored in here. And if you just, if you open the neck of the balloon a little bit, you could let the energy out really slowly and eventually the balloon would deflate. But you know what happens if you take a pin and stick it in a balloon, you get a bang. And the idea is that if you could take one of these isomers or some of these isomers and find the way to the spark, the pin that would prick it, it would make a really big bang.
Exactly. And this is, nuclear isomers have fascinated physicists for years, but both a sort of an interesting area of nuclear physics, but also precisely for what you talked about, trying to find that mechanism, that trigger to either release this air or the energy slowly, perhaps as an energy source, or more intriguing for those who work in the nuclear weapons establishment, if you could find that pinprick that would pop the balloon to let all this energy out at once. And that's really what nuclear isomers are about, stored up energy and the interest in them for applications. How do you release that energy? If you could do it, If you could do it quickly and efficiently, you theoretically have the makings of a great new bomb.
Yeah, and the appeal, part of the appeal for the people in defense would be that it wouldn't take very much, that the amount of isomer that you would need to get this big bang is not very much. So that's and one of the things in defense that they're interested in is making powerful weapons small, you know, within the design of nuclear weapons. One of the big things that has happened, well, I don't know, recently, but one of the things that has happened is they've made the weapons smaller and smaller. So
exactly.
For them, the idea that it'd be smaller, that's a good thing. So to be able to pack a really big bang in a very small package, that has great appeal.
Right. And this also goes into sort of lore of the nuclear weapons establishment. You know, every few years, people will talk theoretically about a nuclear hand grenade, you know, sort of a new, you know, even nuclear weapons, which are relatively small for the power they, you know, for the punch they provide. You know, there are often ways thought about, you know, how do you make them smaller and more powerful? And so it's sort of a joke in the nuclear weapons establishment, you know, a nuclear hand grenade. And the joke is that, you know, even if you could do it, obviously, you know, who could throw it without being killed?
Mm-hmm.
And the way I was introduced to the nuclear isomer bomb was that, you know, people were actually briefing this concept, a concept of a nuclear hand grenade, and this is really how it came to the attention of a lot of those in the defense and scientific establishment.
And apparently also part of the appeal for people in the defense establishment of this kind of weapon, the idea of this kind of weapon, is that the way that it works is very different from the nuclear weapons that we know now. And that if you could develop a weapon like this, that existing agreements on weapons wouldn't cover these things because they would be because they're by their fundamental nature, by the way that they work, it would be completely different.
Right. And that's also one of the reasons why the defense establishment has been interested in nuclear isomers and nuclear isomer weapons over the years. Now, of course, this is all theoretically. If it worked, there would certainly be a big debate and an argument about whether or not this fell under arms control treaties. But the fact that it might not, or probably wouldn't, according to some advocates, has certainly been one of the things that has established interest in it.
Mm. Well, the story, this is, now that I want to point out to people that in the book you do make some reference to other very unconventional weapons research that goes on in the Pentagon, but that this particular story, the story of the isomer bomb, is the one that goes all the way through. And there is one character who also goes all the way through imaginary weapons. He's a scientist named Carl Collins, who has been involved in the basic kind of research. He apparently was interested in this idea that you could produce a great deal of energy from the isomer if you could, to go back to the image, if you could find the pin that would make the balloon explode. So this was something that he did a lot of research in, and he claimed that he indeed found a way to do that.
Yes, and you know, nuclear isomers have always had sort of, you know, what I like to call a cult following. Of people who are very interested in trying to make applications. You know, some of this interest has been very good science, and, you know, some of it perhaps not. In the case of this professor down in Texas, Carl Collins, you know, this was something that had fascinated him for a couple decades. You know, going back to some work he'd done during the Cold War in Romania, he'd gotten some funding under the Reagan administration under the old Star Wars, the ballistic missile defense shield that would protect us from Soviet ICBMs. And he'd always been a character of controversy. A lot of the physicists who had known him really always doubted his results. But, you know, these kind of controversies went on for years, and, you know, people disagreed, and it went back and forth. But what really brought him to kind of, you know, scientific attention was that the unusual way these results came about. You know, basically, in 1998, he conducted an experiment down in his lab in Texas, and he didn't have a lot of funding at that point. You know, Star Wars was long over. And some friends of his had gotten the Pentagon to give money to his wife's company to buy a sample of this nuclear isomer. It was called hafnium. And so she bought this hafnium, and then he bought a used dental x-ray machine for, I think it was $1,500. And he beamed this dental x-ray machine on the hafnium and claimed what struck many as an astounding result. He claimed that he had found that sort of pinprick that could, you know, pop this balloon. And those results, were they true, would have important implications for weapons. And so immediately the preprint of the paper started circulating through the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the nuclear weapons establishment, and everyone was talking about it. And immediately there were some doubts. The experiment itself sounded a little odd. Dental x-rays are not really high-precision equipment. The results violated some physics, and there were other just sort of basic problems that people had with the paper, and that's sort of what really got the controversy rolling.
When Carl Collins began this research, was his interest in weapons research, or was it in the more sort of basic idea that if you could figure out a way to do this, there would be a tremendous release of energy, and no doubt you could do different sorts of things with that. It wouldn't necessarily be something that you would put into a bomb. What drove his interest in the first place?
Well, that was one of the things that I try to explore in the book, and that really sort of fascinated me, is what motivated him as a person. And there are a lot of interesting questions there. For example, whenever we spoke, and I did hours and hours of interviews with him, he said, "I'm just a scientist. I'm just interested in basic research. The weapons, that's a matter for the Pentagon. That's a matter for other people." But then at the same time, I would find out that he was giving briefings for years to the Pentagon with pictures of, golf balls that were exploding, comparing isomers to TNT. And so on one hand, to reporters, he would say, "I'm just a basic scientist. Poor Alfred Noble, dynamite, look what he did." But at the same time, he was pitching weapons to the Pentagon, which was clear from his briefings. So it really was this dichotomy. From my own standpoint, I think it wasn't that he was interested in a weapon for weapon's sake. He really wanted to make the scientific breakthrough and was willing to pitch it sort of, any way it would work.
Mm-hmm. Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for anyone who has tuned in the past few minutes. We're talking with Sharon Weinberger. She is a journalist who's reported on national security and defense technology since 2001 for a variety of publications, including Slate and Washington Post magazine. She's editor of Defense Technology International. And the story that we're talking about here this morning can be found in her recent book, Imaginary Weapons. It's published by Nation Books. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So Carl Collins did this experiment, and he claimed that he got this result, that he could demonstrate the ideas that you could trigger the isomer to release this energy. Other people in the field of theoretical physics looked at what he had done, and they said, "Well, we're not so sure about that." Some other people had tried to replicate his experiment, and apparently, and you correct me if I'm wrong, no one could.
Well, it's pretty much true. The only one who could was one of the original participants in that experiment, an Air Force scientist named Patrick McDaniel, who was a colleague of Collins. He claimed to replicate it. But this, since it was part of the original group, it was never considered an independent replication. And basically what happened from there was that a group of about a dozen scientists from across the Department of Energy's national laboratories organized a huge collaboration to do another experiment to see, okay, we don't think it's right, but, strange things happen in physics, so let's at least try it. And they tried, they worked at an advanced x-ray facility using, much more precise equipment, much better equipment. And in, I believe it was 2000, they replicated the original experiment and got no results. Carl Collins, the Texas scientist who did the original experiment, came back and said, "Oh, well, they did it all wrong." And so they said, "Okay, we're going to do it again." And, these experiments are quite expensive. So they went back again a year later, and they did it again. And again, no results. And in the meantime, Carl Collins had a student who had gone on to another university, and he tried to replicate the experiment several times. And again, no results. And in the meantime, there were two independent advisory boards commissioned by the government to look at these results. And again, they found problems with the experiment, theoretical issues, experimental issues. And they said even beyond all that, the idea of a bomb out of this stuff just really wouldn't make much sense.
One concern was that that they decided that the isomer that seemed to be the best possibility was something that, as you mentioned, something called hafnium. Well, first of all, even if you were thinking about building these weapons, you'd have to produce hafnium, so that you would have to invest literally tens of billions of dollars in an infrastructure to produce this stuff. It's very difficult to deal with because it's highly radioactive. You would actually have to shield the weapon because of the hafnium that sort of defeated the idea of it being small enough so that you could hold it in your hand. It apparently throws off, when it explodes, it would actually throw off a lot of radiation, which would make it really dirty. So on top of the initial questions about whether it would work at all, there were these additional questions about the fact that even if it would work, there are probably a lot of good reasons why you'd say, "Well, we don't want to do it anyway."
Right. And these of, you know, theoretical and very real-world practical problems began to pile up. And as these problems began to pile up, you would think that the Pentagon would have backed off this idea, but a strange thing happened. The opposite happened. You know, even as these counter-experiments piled up and these outside advisory boards and these very obvious arguments against why it wouldn't be such a great bomb, the Pentagon's R&D arm, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, started up a program to spend, you know, upwards of $30 million over a couple years. And in the meantime, you know, they had DARPA had assembled a panel of experts looking at ways to produce this hafnium isomer, you know, talking about building facilities that would cost in the billions of dollars. So, you know, here we have an experiment that was dubious at best, and yet the Pentagon had already started this program, you know, saying, well, you know, how would we build these multi-billion dollar hafnium production facilities?
And this also was after, I think this was after this group of science advisors who had been advising the Department of Defense for a long time. These are these people called referred to as the Jasons. They worked for the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, and that this was at the time, I think, of the Clinton administration. There was somebody in the administration who was looking at this and just wanted to sort of size it up, and turned over the issue to these scientists who had been advising for a long time, and they looked at these various questions, and their conclusion was, it doesn't make sense. We don't think it would work. Even if it would, there were all these other questions. So you would think that at that point, when these scientists, whose job it was to advise the Department of Defense, said, this doesn't make sense, you would think at that point the door on this project should have been closed.
Right. Yes. And this group, the Jasons, it includes multiple Nobel Prize winners. It's a group of very, very established scientists. And they're brought in on controversies like these for the specific reasons that sometimes these things are hard to resolve. And, you know, they had rejected this idea out of hand. And it's a part of what I try to figure out in the book is, you know, why is it that ideas like this, even though they're panned by the scientific establishment, by advisory bodies, you know, by technical experts in government, how is it that they live on? And that's part of what I talk about in terms of the scientific underworld, that you get this cadre of sort of true believers in government who the philosophy is, and it's a good philosophy at its base of high risk, high payoff, that, you know, we'll invest in a bunch of ideas, and even if a lot of them fail, you know, if one of them is a breakthrough one and it pays off, it's worth it. But the problem with this philosophy, when you get to this cadre of true believers, is that they tend to invest in all bad ideas, because if you only invest in the bad ideas and the things that are just, you know, theoretically impossible, there's not going to be any payoff. It's sort of high risk, high payoff versus foolish risk, no payoff. And that's really the trap that the hafnium bomb fell into, and then sort of other fringe projects that I explore in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, then I guess I still, I'm sure, though, that people on the true believer side would still be prepared to argue that there is some theoretical possibility, however slim, that such a thing could work. And I'm sure that they would continue to argue that it makes sense to spend some money and effort. And also, I'm sure they would raise the issue of the other guys, whoever the other guys are. They would say, well, you know, we think that at one time it would have been the Soviet Union. Who knows? It may now be Russia. Who knows now who it could be? China. It could be anybody. Who would say, we're confident that other places, other regimes that might not necessarily be our friends, are doing this kind of research. And, you know, we don't want to have an isomer bomb gap like we used to talk about during the Cold War. And they would say, look, for the reason that it might work and the reason that somebody else might get it first, well, we really need to be doing this.
Right. And of course, those arguments crop up repeatedly in history. There was, for instance, the missile gap during the Cold War, which turned out didn't exist. There was the mythical, you know, Soviet nuclear fission-powered bomber, which turned out it didn't exist either. And then, of course, you know, the more contemporary one is, you know, the imaginary weapons of destruction in Iraq. And so, you know, sometimes mistakes will happen. But, you know, I think that the troubling thing that I find in this book is that it's happening more often as government sort of either disdains technical expertise, or we simply don't have that resident expertise in government. And true believers will always have an excuse. And you could say, well, what's the harm? But the problem is that the world is filled with fantastic ideas, you know, perpetual motion machines, fantastic imaginary weapons. And Yes, mistakes will be made, to kind of put it in the passive, but there really should be a process for filtering out the ones that might be wrong versus the ones that are just plain foolish. And really the best methods we have, at least in science, are peer review and reproducibility within the scientific establishment.
We have a couple of callers here, and I want to get to them. They've been patient, and we'll just do that right now, starting with Champaign County and line number one. Hello.
Hi. I would see this as an outlier for all of the other defense spending that's going on, in a way that this one is perhaps ludicrous, and I don't think they're even framing it right, and I think you're picking up the way they're framing it. Rather than calling this an isotope bomb, you would call it a chain reaction bomb, where the chain reaction is done more carefully or in a way that isn't known right now, because that's what needs to be established. All atoms have lots of energy tied up with them. Isomers that are radioactive are unstable. They can be broken in pieces and cause a chain reaction. Now, it seems to, I don't know the mechanism, but I would guess that basically the guy is saying I can establish a chain reaction in a different way. So I would suggest that you might look into that and try to use that kind of language, because just calling it an isotope bomb, I think, is probably just picking up some ignorance from the Pentagon, as a matter of fact. And who would pull the pin on a nuclear hand grenade anyway? It seems ludicrous. I don't know if you've looked into some of the earlier historical reference on this. There's a great book called Arming the Heavens by a guy named Jack Mano out of Syracuse, who looks into the kind of mad fancy at the very beginning of the space race and even before that, the nuclear age, rods of God and all sorts of bizarre things that were speculated on, and a lot of money was dumped into much of it. He even makes the case that the space shuttle was upsized for a military use as sort of a bizarre rapid deployment device, and that's why we're stuck with something that's so huge, trusting lives of seven people to something that could be quite a bit smaller, because we have all this storage space on it where you can actually send up anything you want to send up and dock it later, rather than putting people through the more physically stressing launch of something that's so much massive. So it's a great resource. I don't know if you looked into that. But going back to reprising my first point, it just seems like this is an outlier, and there is this juggernaut of defense spending that just, that Eisenhower warned us about. It's the Iron Triangle, et cetera. I'll listen.
Yeah, okay. Well, go ahead.
The gentleman actually brings up a wonderful point at the beginning about a chain reaction, because that's actually precisely one of the problems pointed out by this advisory group called the Jasons when they first looked at the idea of a nuclear isomer bomb. They said that even if you find a way to trigger the release of this energy, you have to do it quickly, like you do in a nuclear weapon. So you need a chain reaction. Well, in a nuclear weapon, neutrons kind of, that's what causes the chain reaction. And there was no mechanism for doing this with nuclear isomers. It doesn't produce more. It doesn't produce anything that can trigger it so quickly. And so one of the lovely analogies that the Jasons use is it's not just enough to have energy. And what they talk about is, they say a jelly donut has twice the energy density of TNT. Well, why isn't a jelly donut a great explosive? Because there's no way to release that energy quickly. And so they kind of, they've often used this jelly donut analogy. Yes, you can store energy in things, but the question is, how can you release it? The other point that the gentleman brings up about the Iron Triangle, that's another element. And it's the isomer bomb is sort of a microcosm of how a crazy idea becomes a weapons project. Eisenhower really did understand some of these problems in a larger scale. When you get into things like missile defense, they're in the billions of dollars, then these things really take on a life of their own, because there's entrenched interest in congressional districts and in the defense industry. And then you're not only battling, scientists, and the scientific establishment, you're also battling entrenched, congressional and economic interests, and it becomes that much harder.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another caller. This is Urbana in line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
This is fascinating. I was wondering if, I have 2 points. First, is there any residual influence from the late Dr. Edward Teller in this? Is there a group in the Pentagon that might be called like an atomic Atomic Weapon Club who think atomic weapons are just the neatest thing ever. And I'll listen to what you have to say on both of those.
Okay. Well,
sure. Actually, you know, I always like to say if you scratch any crazy idea somewhere, it's sort of like the 7 degrees of separation of Edward Teller. They all go back to Edward Teller. And I mean that in a good sense and a bad sense. You know, Edward Teller was certainly a very controversial figure as, you know, the father of the hydrogen bomb, but he was also recognized as a brilliant physicist. At the same time, as even his friends like to or don't like to acknowledge, he entertained a lot of junky ideas. You know, he was interested in things. And so one of the people in the book that I interview is Mort Weiss, a scientist out at the Livermore Lab, who was an associate of Edward Teller. And Mort Weiss had worked on isomers and the idea of isomer weapons back in the 1980s, did the theoretical work, decided it really wasn't possible. And he recalls discussing this idea of a nuclear isomer bomb with Edward Teller. And, you know, Teller kept challenging him of ways it might work. And finally, as they went through all these ways, you know, Teller realized, okay, this wasn't going to work, and he dropped it. And the point that this person makes in the book that I quote him saying is, you know, Teller loved wild ideas, and he loved crazy ideas, but at the end, he recognized that science was a discipline, and the isomer bomb in that sense wasn't going to work. And I'm sorry, with the second part of that question, I've already forgotten.
Is it the case that within the Pentagon, maybe within the defense establishment, there are some people who just have this great enthusiasm for nuclear weapons?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the more fascinating things about this book. There's a small part in the book where I talk about sort of the shock of, you know, I would walk into, you know, government weapons scientist's office, and they would all have, not all of them, but a great number of them would have pictures of sort of their favorite nuclear weapons tests. From the Cold War, you know, sometimes a screensaver, sometimes it's pictures on the wall. And I finally asked one of them why they did this. And one of them really sent me this very beautiful and touching explanation that, you know, for those scientists in government who worked on nuclear weapons, it was sort of like a club. And, you know, everyone was proud of their work, and it was sort of, you know, the sexy thing in the Cold War to be working on. And now, you know, we don't do nuclear weapons full tests, and so it sort of lost its glamour. We're in the post-Cold War world, but they still feel like they're part of a club. And that's part of what I think, you know, both encourages some areas of fringe science, but also keeps it in check, where these people take the science of weapons very seriously. And so when they see the process going wrong, they're very sort of insulted by bad science.
Let's take another call. This is Champagne in line 3.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm another Sharon. My name is Sharon Gamari Tabrizi, and I wrote a book about Herman Kahn. And I wanted to ask you about access to nuclear scientists, and I want to begin with a little story. When I was working on my book, I interviewed Sam Cohn, who was not only one of the designers of the neutron bomb, but he told me a crazy story about an imaginary weapon called the Red Mercury weapon. And he gave me a long story about how it was suppressed by the Pentagon, and it was a politicized suppression. And when I was excited about hearing about your book, and I went on the web, and I saw that there was a website that imitated your title by somebody who was highly critical of your book, and took very personal, kind of almost slanderous statements about you. And I wanted to ask you about your experience of the politicization and the strong emotions involved in talking to scientists and Pentagon officials when you're talking about pet projects, nuclear weapons, or special weapons ideas. I don't know if you feel comfortable talking about that other website, but I wonder if in general, you could address the question of access to scientists or getting involved in personal agendas where you get caught up in other people's business.
Sure. Actually, no, I don't mind the question at all, and I'll try to address both those points. First, yeah, part of what made this story so unique and part of what really outraged scientists was that they saw that the science of this controversy was going completely awry and that the main scientists involved, Carl Collins, was making these very personal attacks on the scientists who were disputing his results. And so after the book came out, you know, I have my little author's webpage, which is, you know, imaginaryweapons.com.
Right.
The main person of the book, him and his wife, took out a counter website at imaginaryweapons.net. And
right.
It's basically dedicated to bashing me as an author. And, you know, I suppose it's you know, certainly the book is very critical of Carl Collins. And so he has a right to answer it publicly. that he's done it in sort of this very unusual way is to me just a continuation of the politics described in the book. It's actually, I encourage people to look at the website. It's very interesting.
It's actually kind of scary, and what I wanted to know is, did you send him a copy of the manuscript in advance for his comments, or did your lawyers at The Nation say you can do a slanderous, you know, cease and desist kind of suit, or how did you choose to handle it?
I've chosen to handle it by doing nothing. I think that, unfortunately for him, the website speaks for itself. It's sort of scary when you look at it to think that the Pentagon was basing what could have been a multi-billion-dollar weapons project, and you kind of look at what his outlook is on life.
Mm-hmm.
But from my standpoint, you know, I'm a journalist, and you know, he has the right to answer it. It's sort of inappropriate the way he's answered it, perhaps, but. It, you know, the book speaks for itself, and I'm very happy just standing by the book and allowing him to do what he wants to do. The issue you bring up of scientists is very interesting, you know, and the idea, I don't know much about Sam Cohn. I do know that he is one of these people who's become kind of involved on the fringes of science. You know, but these stories, the issue of red mercury that you bring up is something that I also talk about in this book. Red mercury is one of these things, it's sort of like an isomer bomb. It started emerging in the press during, I think after the fall of the Soviet Union as this mysterious substance that was being sold on the black market. And, you know, it was rumored to be everything from, you know, radioactive materials to, you know, fusion bomb materials. And finally, the International Atomic Energy Agency just came out and said, this is baloney. The stuff doesn't exist, and these press reports keep living on about it. And so I talk a little bit about this in the book because this is another example of things that sort of, you know, exist without evidence but you know, are sort of used as scare tactics, you know, that there's this red mercury material on the market, and people weren't listening to what scientists said, which is that this stuff doesn't exist. But, you know, the issue of dealing with scientists is, you know, there are lots of scientific controversies. You know, one of my colleagues likes to say, you know, they're usually discussed at scientific conferences, and it doesn't end in, you know, name-calling. What made the isomer bomb such an unusual story, as well as many of these fringe science stories in the Pentagon, is they do become, you know, scientists who operate at the fringes don't operate within sort of the mores and manners of the scientific establishment. Rather than arguing it out in the journals, they do, unfortunately, what Carl Collins has done, where they attack the colleagues, they attack other scientists, and in this case, they attack me. So, you know, these things happen.
I have one follow-up question, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
But what about more mainstream stuff, like the fudging of the tests with polymer balloons for the ballistic missile where there was a kind of, what was it, the guidance system had to find a heat signature, and they helped the test along by using Mylar balloons, which would be cooler than the target. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Right. And you know, this is a different extension of the same problem of what I consider a lack of scientific expertise and willingness to turn to scientific experts. You know, as this, we've invested about $10 billion a year in missile defense. Now, this is not fringe science per se, but this is an example where scientists and technical experts have really come out and said, you know, these tests are very scripted, you know, that the test missiles have beacons on them that provide information that wouldn't be provided in a real test. You know, the decoys that are being used are not realistic decoys, and this is a long-standing issue of missile defense going back years. You know, at least you can say that during the Reagan administration under Star Wars, there were actually some very good technical experts and reviews going on missile defense, at least at the time. That doesn't mean that the schemes were any less crazy, but there really was scientific oversight. There was a scientist, Gerald Yonis, who is, I believe, the deputy chief of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization, a very good scientist, very respected. You don't see a lot of that now. You don't really see any technical, you know, outside scientific independent oversight of the missile defense system, and I think we're really paying the price for that in dollars.
Well, I mean, so my point was that this is not fringe science, and these are in fact imaginary weapons in one sense, but this is very mainstream Pentagon science, where the actual peer-reviewed physicists' critiques, like the gentleman from MIT, Ted Postol, their critiques become classified.
Right. Well, these are all extensions of fringe science. I mean, the missile defense is not military psychics. I mean, you have some really, really far examples of fringe science, which I do think the nuclear isomer bomb belongs to. But then you get sort of the gray areas like missile defense. Well, the missile defense system really does exist. It can do things. It just probably can't do what they claim it can do. But yes, this is one of the things you see where secrecy is used to cover up what may be technical problems. Increasingly, the Missile Defense Agency says it doesn't want to, release results of its tests for fear that, this would, show people it wouldn't work, and God forbid, other nations know that, let alone the American public. In the case of the nuclear isomer bomb, Professor Carl Collins is now claiming, oh, there are replications of my experiment, but they're classified. For a scientist who doesn't have a security clearance, that's a pretty far claim to make. But again, you see this in many projects where secrecy is used to cover up technical failures and bad science.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, thanks. I have another caller here I want to get to in just a second, but to go back for a moment to the isomer bomb, you talk about the fact that over time it seems that it's an idea that just won't die, that people,
right.
Somebody will bring it up and say, hey, doesn't that sound cool? They'll think about it. They'll realize that there are a lot of problems. Then they'll go on to something else. And then some time will go by, and then somebody else will say, hey, what about that isomer bomb? It somehow keeps coming around. What is the status now of this kind of research, and is there still money going into the idea of the isomer bomb?
Well, there were some big events back in 2004, and the first was that I published a cover story in the Washington Post magazine detailing the status of the controversy at that point. That article attracted a lot of interest, mostly from Congress, which really kind of stepped in and said, well, wait a minute, why are you doing this huge funding of a project that's so scientifically controversial? And moreover, if this is a nuclear weapon, we kind of have rules about this. And so they went in, and first the Defense Committee zeroed out the money for the DARPA project on the isomer bomb. And so you would think, oh, that would be the end of it. But it's the nature, I like to say it's the nature of bad ideas in government, that they never die. And so that same year, the Department of Energy bill slipped in $5 million for isomer production, and we don't know what else because the Department of Energy won't say. And so there continues to be money that goes on in this area. In fact, in May, there was what was called a hafnium review panel met in Washington under the auspices of the Department of Energy, also with Pentagon involvement. And now what they're doing is they're not even inviting the critics, and they're saying, oh, yes, well, our recent experiments, worked. But they're not getting a lot of money. But basically they're doing what all fringe science does. They wait, and they sort of lie in wait and hope the issue dies down, and then they rediscover the idea and get more funding. And that is really how these ideas never die in government.
Let me introduce again our guest, Sharon Weinberger. She's reported on national security and defense technology since 2001 for, among other publications, Slate and the Washington Post magazine. She is the editor of Defense Technology International. It's a bimonthly editorial supplement to Aviation Week and Space Technology. And the book that we're talking about here, if you're interested in reading it, is Imaginary Weapons, A Journey Through the Pentagon's Scientific Underworld. It's published by Nation Books. And we have another caller here, so we want to get them into the conversation on our line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, just a few comments. One is, from a much broader standpoint, nuclear proliferation, and also, the building of the bunker bomb, that kind of thing. I mean, aren't these much broader issues or something or other to, we let these things out of the box and all of a sudden then we run around, So I don't know. What's your comment there?
Sure. In fact, the gentleman talks about the nuclear bunker buster. The formal name of this program is the Robust Nuclear Earth Penetrator. And the idea there, and this is a very live debate right now in Washington and the Pentagon, is the administration has been pushing for funds to develop a new type of we have a nuclear bunker buster in our inventory, but the idea is to develop a new and better one. And this is a weapon that would basically burrow deep into the ground and set off a nuclear charge with the idea of reaching hardened bunkers, the idea that, leaders or nuclear weapons are stored in these deep underground bunkers. And that's actually one of the ideas behind the isomer bomb. When the head of DARPA was interviewed, he said one of the reasons for developing this nuclear isomer bomb is it would be sort of a great substitute for the nuclear bunker buster. So what's the advantage? Well, nuclear bunker busters would be very, very controversial to use. I mean, the idea that we've, it's so politically would be just such a hot button to use a nuclear weapon other than, in a full-scale war. So the idea was, well, a nuclear isomer weapon, it wouldn't really be a nuclear weapon. Maybe people wouldn't object. And so that was one of the things forwarded. So, yes, the nuclear isomer bomb encapsulates a lot of these arguments over nuclear proliferation and nuclear bunker buster sort of in a microcosm. And that's what I thought made this particular story so interesting, is it touches on all these larger issues.
The other one is that, you know, I just think about if we could send the, you know, spend at least part of this research and development into alternative energy, you know, for our environment and all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, it just boggles your mind sometimes.
That's a wonderful point. You know, what sort of advocates of some of this fringe science will say is, well, you know, the Pentagon spends $250 million on a fighter aircraft. So why are you complaining about $10 million, $20 million on my little project? And my point is, you know, first of all, I once asked a scientist, I said, how much would a Nobel Prize winner, like how much money would a Nobel Prize winner get for their laboratory? And I was told, oh, you know, $1 million a year might be pretty great. So $20 to $30 million in basic science is a heck of a lot of money. And the same thing, you know, we are lacking basic armor and up-armoring for our vehicles, for our troops in Iraq. $20 to $30 million is a lot of money for that, too. And finally, as you point out, it's also the cost of lost opportunities. The Pentagon now is thinking, oh, what, you know, we should be investing in alternative energy. So $20 to $30 million wasted in a weapon that will never work is $20 to $30 million that's not being invested in the next breakthrough in alternative energy. And that's just a shame. And it's the cost of what I call lost opportunities.
Good program.
All right, well, thanks for the call. And we certainly have time for other comments. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have about 10 minutes. We talked about how this the story sort of gets going with this research that was done by the scientist Carl Collins back in the late 90s, where he said that he demonstrated isomer triggering. He demonstrated the fact that you could take this isomer. He had a very small amount of this stuff. And bombarded it with the X-rays from the used dental X-ray machine and said that he saw this effect. Other scientists, other people within physics, looked at the work, said, well, we're really not so sure. Other scientists tried to replicate it. They could not. So generally within the physics community, within the scientific community, it seemed that his work was discredited, and he may have been discredited, or at least people believe that he hadn't demonstrated what he said that he did. But there, I guess that what happened is that at that point, nobody outside of the physics community would have known who he was and would have known about the work. Then when you wrote the story for the Post in 2004, then it became a much more public kind of story, and perhaps he has, you know, whatever difficulties he had with his work as a result of how people in the physics world think about it, he's now fixed on you as being responsible for blackening his name, and that's why he has personally launched this effort, this sort of counter effort to counter the book, and where he really, essentially, he seems to think that you're a bad person and you have done something bad to him.
Right, and this is the fascinating thing. You know, I'd found out that over the years this was standard operating procedure. You know, there was a San Francisco Chronicle article that had been critical of him in the late 1990s, and, you know, he attacked the author of that. There was a Physics Today journalist who was trying to write on the controversy, and he attacked the author of that. And so this really became, and he did the same with scientists. So in a way, this wasn't a surprise for me. It was sort of disappointing. You know, he would call his former student all sorts of names. You know, after the book came out, I started getting, you know, emails from all these professors who had dealt with him in other controversies. At one point, you know, someone had written to him to complain about something, and he threatened lawsuits. So this was really sort of, you know, not unexpected. It's sort of tragic because most controversies, you know, scientific disputes happen all the time. They happen in all areas. And sometimes there's some bad feelings, but they're resolved through the scientific method and through the scientific process, and people go on with their lives. But to kind of escalate it into a name-calling, you know, against your colleagues in the scientific establishment, against journalists, against people in government, that's what really has made this conflict so unusual. I mean, certainly for me as a journalist.
Hmm. We have another call here there in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Isn't this just like all the other things that it makes money? War makes money for some people. Arms make money for some people. We pay for it, and nobody questions it because it's whatever defense or whatever. It's just sort of like the old greed thing. Wouldn't this be the same reason that they would put money into something that they know is not going to work because somebody's making a profit out of it?
Right. There are certainly some in the scientific establishment who felt Carl Collins was motivated by greed. To be honest, I really never felt that way. I think he was much more motivated by the idea that most scientists never make it to the top. And so if you could be the one to make a scientific breakthrough, that sort of elevates you. And I think that's what pushes a lot of scientists over into the scientific underworld, this sort of overreaching ambition. You know, in this case, whether how much was money was motivated, it's really hard to say. I think what one person pointed out to me after the book came out that I thought was very interesting is you don't just get fringe science in the Pentagon, but they said sometimes the Pentagon breeds fringe science. That sometimes, you know, scientists who want to conduct honest work are sort of pushed into making wild claims because, you know, if they're doing some basic research and it doesn't have weapons applications, they're worried about losing their funding. So sometimes they're tempted to, you know, make far-fetched claims. I think a good example of this is antimatter. This is a wonderful area of scientific research. It sounds out of Star Trek, but it's true. You know, antimatter explodes when it comes into contact with regular matter. The problem is that the technology to produce this stuff is generations away, at least, as even people working in it admit. But most of them are working in it for basic science. But they've started to throw in words about, you know, weapons and bombs into their proposals because they know it will attract interest. And so they're sort of being pushed into the fringe because they know that might be the only way they can get funded. So that's the other flip side of the problem.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. One of the basic sort of things that you deal with, and I think it'd be good to talk about, is the quality of advice, or maybe the lack of quality advice in Washington when it comes to scientific and technological issues, and whether indeed the government, this government or any government, pays enough attention to scientists who they may actually solicit for their opinions, or maybe over time we have sort of undercut that, the way that that kind of advice gets into the policy stream, so that in fact decisions on scientific and technological issues are being made without good advice.
Right. I think there's two things, sort of a push-pull there, two factors at work. The first is, in general, the number, kind of sort of the innate scientific expertise we have in government is going away. And part of that is just by accident. It's not nefarious. And part of it perhaps is. The first part is during the 1990s with the peace dividend. We started outsourcing a lot. We cut back on some of our in-house Department of Defense laboratories, on some of the scientists there. There was downsizing. And, you know, a lot of our large major military programs were outsourced. You know, responsibility of it was given to defense companies. And again, this wasn't so much nefarious, but then we sort of lost some of our sort of, you know, internal scientific expertise within our national security establishments. That's the first part. And the second part is a little bit more nefarious. It's simply a lot of these positions were you know, deemed no longer necessary. One of the people I interviewed in the book was the chief scientist in the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, which became part of the State Department. That sort of chief scientist position really no longer exists. The Jasons, this group of eminent scientists that reviewed the idea of a nuclear isomer bomb, they were almost fired from, you know, their contract was dropped by the Pentagon, I believe, in 2003, you know, when basically there was a dispute with the Pentagon over membership. Now, there was a big outcry over that, so they were moved to another part of the Pentagon and saved. But again, they've sort of been shunted off some of the major reviews. They don't review things like missile defense, for example, anymore. And so I think there has been, in some cases, you know, this idea, well, what do we need scientific expertise for? You know, we have policy to take care of.
And that, it seems in that particular case of the shoving aside of the Jasons, was that motivated by the fact that the people there in the Pentagon didn't like the advice that they were being given? So what they did was they said, well, we don't like what you're telling us, so get out of here?
It was a little more complicated than that. As the story goes, the Defense Secretary Rumsfeld felt that he wanted to move the Jasons in a different direction, and he asked that they appoint three Silicon Valley CEOs to this group. And that's been against everything the group has always stood for. They've always chosen their members internally based on scientific credentials, not based on who you know or based on what business you've run. And so they refused to do this. It would have, you know, went against how the group operated. And as the story goes, you know, their contract was dropped because of that. And again, there was an outcry, and they were moved to another part of the Pentagon, but there really was felt that, you know, there was this bridge burned. And it goes back to the idea that, you know, you can either have groups tell you what you want to hear, and that's one purpose of them, or you really can try to get independent scientific advice. And I think that's harder and harder to come by. know, you have other advisory boards like the Defense Science Board, which, you know, is a very good board and they do things, but most of the members of it have associations, either direct or indirect, with the defense industry. The one thing that's been unique historically about the JASNs is that they're all pretty much academic scientists. They purposely don't have any interest in the defense industry or the areas they're looking at. And that sort of impartial scientific advice is something really unique and something very much, I think, needed when you're spending, you know, millions, let alone billions of dollars.
Hmm. We're almost at the point here we have to finish. We have a couple of minutes left. And we've talked a lot about the hafnium bomb, this isomer bomb. That's the main story that runs all the way through the book. But you do talk about other things. And, for example, you just touched on a couple of minutes ago about the idea of antimatter weapons, that if you could produce antimatter, you know what happens when matter and antimatter come together, you'd definitely get a big bang. And that there actually might be some idea to think that there's somewhere to go with that. Is there something else that just stands out, though, in your mind as being one of the, when you heard about it and when you tell other people about it, so wacky, so strange that you would think on the face of it you would have to say it was ridiculous, and that yet money was put into researching the possible military use of it?
I think my favorite example is the use of psychics in the military, and this was supported as research by the CIA and DIA. And the idea, it was technically called remote viewing, studying whether psychics could, you know, spot new submarines just by imagining them in their head or, you know, the location of missile silos. And after the book came out, there was one gentleman who's still involved in the, you know, sort of military advising, and he said, you know, you just don't understand. You know, if only you knew that they were used operationally, we had operational use of psychics that worked great, then you'd realize how great this program was. But unfortunately, that's all still classified. And, you know, it's... You know, on its face, you know, the idea that our military used psychics operationally is, to me, even scarier than the fact that we researched the idea. But again, this is another example of where secrecy can be used to cover scientific advice. You know, that this gentleman's point was, well, yes, the scientific studies of psychics didn't work out too much, but why rely on laboratory results when there's operational uses of them? Well, you know, I guess we may still have to wait then the declassification of, you know, the military psychic programs to know the whole truth, but I certainly have my doubts about this.
Well, that indeed suggests, as we sort of talked about earlier, that when you're doing this kind of reporting, that's very difficult because so much of it is classified. People just won't talk about it.
It's difficult, but I do think you can rely on the evidence we have at hand. And when secrecy is used as an excuse for why things that seem on its face to be ridiculous, then, you know, you can begin to draw some conclusions, because you can always claim, you know, we don't know what we don't know, and not everyone has access to classified information. But, you know, I like to say that, you know, nature bats last. Nature doesn't lie, and we can rely on basic, you know, natural phenomenon to make decisions about what we fund and don't fund. Hmm.
Well, there we will stop. And again, if you'd like to read the book, it's Imaginary Weapons by our guest Sharon Weinberger. It's published by Nation Books. Sharon Weinberger has reported on national security and defense technology for Slate, for the Washington Post magazine. She's editor of Defense Technology International. And Ms. Weinberg, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Support for the broadcast today comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning, starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods, and food and original works of art. Located near the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in downtown Urbana, information available at 384-2444. Coming up later today on the afternoon magazine, Celeste Quinn talks with reporter and editor Jed Horn. He calls Hurricane Katrina an unnatural disaster, an essentially man-made disaster. He's metro editor for the Times-Picayune of New Orleans. He's also author of a new book, Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina and the Near Death of a Great American City. He'll be talking with Celeste Quinn in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine today. We're going to take a break. We usually do. We'll have some news from NPR before that, an update on the market. Stay tuned.